Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network, sponsored by TBILaw.com. For automatic reminders about this radio show and other great survivor events, sign up now for TBISN.org.
When Attorney Gordon Johnson speaks about recovery, he isn't talking about the amount of money a survivor gets from a lawsuit or settlement. He is talking about getting better from the brain injury. Find him on the web at TBILaw.com or call 800-992-9447.
And now, it is time for another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show. Good evening, everybody, from the sunny today Midwest. Very happy to see that. I thought after the last couple of days that maybe we were fully into that gray, cold, rainy fall, but today was just beautiful. The colors are popping off of the trees as the leaves are changing. Not quite convertible weather today. That, well, let's hope maybe we can squeeze one or two of those out. This is Kim Justice, in case you didn't catch that, on Brain Injury Radio this evening. This show is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. I introduce topics and survivors share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. Tune in, stop in, and call in. This is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. Really excited about my guest tonight for a couple of reasons, and I'm going to tell you those in just a moment. I'm going to do a little housekeeping real quick. I'd like to thank the Brain Injury Radio sponsor, Gordon Johnson of TBI Law. If you have any litigation issues regarding your brain injury, check out TBILaw.com. I'd also like to share with you and thank my show sponsor, Lash Publishing, and I'll put that in the chat room in just a couple of minutes, but it's lapublishing.com. They're just a wonderful organization. In fact, I thought, hang on, I can't do two things at once, publishing.com. Sorry about that. Some of you guys who follow the Brain Injury Radio Facebook page saw that I had a lot of action in the last week of getting to meet some wonderful people. When my sponsor approached me, Marilyn Lash, the owner of Lash Publishing, she's in North Carolina, and I'm in Nebraska, and I never thought that I would get the opportunity to meet her. I guess we've been doing this about 7 months now, and it was wonderful. I'm sorry for the reason, but it was wonderful because I did get to meet Marilyn last week, and I posted that picture. Also, the new executive director, Peggy Reiser of the Nebraska Brain Injury Association, which I didn't know there was one, for the last 18 years. So it was wonderful to meet both ladies, to get to have a chance to have lunch with Marilyn and find out what great gals both of these ladies are, and what they were doing here has a little something to do with my guest, or he might know a little something about this from the other side. But they were having a retreat for wives of men who had TBIs and or PTSD, going over those topics, things like compassion fatigue. As I hear, they had about 90 people, so it was a great turnout here for Hope for the Homefront is what it was called. And so it was a pleasure. I'm pleasure to meet Marilyn and Peggy. Also a pleasure to host that kind of event here in Omaha. I've never been aware of that kind of thing going on around here, but very, very glad we are active now and that I'm getting to interact in that group. My guest tonight is William A. Roper, the Compassionate Warrior. Overcoming enormous physical, mental, and emotional odds, Vietnam veteran William A. Roper has walked the road of devastating traumatic brain and bodily injury all the way to physical thriving and spiritual awakening. Now he is sharing his method and the journey. A student of meditation and new thought, William's mission is to express his gratitude for his own healing by assisting veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury, and anyone engaged in the process of overcoming adversity through igniting their will to achieve their goals. William's message is powerful and inspirational, and his book, The Compassionate Warrior, debuts, which we'll have to ask him, we're on the eve of fall, exactly when that's going to be. But he will be available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and any other online retailers. And as soon as we find out exactly when the book is going to be out, I'll be sure to let you guys know. And I want to let you know that his website is tbivet.com. And after we get started, I'll post that in the chat room. Again, that's tbivet.com. William, are you with us?
Yes.
So glad to have you here tonight, William. I know that you've got a very busy speaking schedule and probably a lot of things going on with the impending release of your book, so it was nice of you to make the time for us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. By the way, the book has been released. It's out and it's available. You can get it at any bookstore.
All right. So, Amazon, I'm assuming, Barnes & Noble, and if you go into any bookstore and just request it, they can order it, right? You're going to show up on the wholesale list?
Exactly.
Super duper.
Now, more than likely, the book is not stocked in a lot of these major retailers, but if you go in there, they will order it for you, for sure.
Right. I found that out myself, so everybody pay attention to that. It's William Roper, R-O-P-E-R-S, and you will see that. Thank you, Tracy, typed into the chat room.
O-S.
I'm sorry, William A. Roper's Compassionate Warrior, Brain Injury. William A. Roper, no S, R-O-P-E-R, The Compassionate Warrior. And again, you'll find that distribution information at tbivet.com. And one of your acquaintances, I believe, Tracy Miller, is here tonight, and she typed that into the chat for me. So thank you, Tracy, and congratulations on the release of your book.
Well, I'm pleased. It was 10 years. It was 10 years in the works.
Oh, it took you 10 years to write it, but the seeds were being planted years before that. It says here that you were a Vietnam vet, so that goes back quite a bit further. You know, back then, I remember my Uncle Tony was in Nam and some other people I knew, and we never heard anything about, at least I was young, but I never heard anything about a traumatic brain injury or any emphasis on brain injury. Yet right now in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're saying that that's going to be the signature wound of people coming back from these wars. And I know that there's loud things going off. Anywhere there's a war going on. Why do you think there were less TBIs in your war, or we just didn't hear about them as much?
We just didn't hear about them as much. It was a best kept secret. It wasn't that they were keeping it from us. It was just they didn't talk about it. It was just one of those things that never came up.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit about your story. What happened to you, the process that you went through, and then obviously that'll lead us to the impetus for you writing the book. And obviously, don't give the story away. We want people to buy it, but you can tell us a little bit about that formula of yours that has helped you overcome whatever you're going to tell us you've been overcoming. One of the things I do say on this program called Recovery Now is that I believe that we're all recovering from something all the time, even if we're just trying to improve. But some of us start in some pretty dark places, and it's a long crawl up to the sunlight. So tell us how your story began.
My story began in the killing fields of Vietnam, where I was thrown from a jeep. My head struck the ground with such force, my brain began to swell uncontrollably, and I was about to die. I was very close to the 24th Evacuation Hospital there in Long Bend, and I don't know how it all happened. I don't remember anything about the accident or anything about my journey up to the time that I arrived at Walter Reed Army Hospital. I was unconscious for some 3 months. I wasn't totally unconscious the whole time. I lapsed in and out of consciousness, and I don't remember anything about how it happened in the first few months. It's just a dark hole in my memory. So anyway, I was in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive of 1968.
Mm-hmm.
The Tet Offensive was when the communists came down from the north along with the Viet Cong, and they teamed up and they attacked all the major military installations in Southeast Asia. And on the morning at 3:30 on the eve, the morning of Tet, that was the official holiday, and they had called a ceasefire. They always had a ceasefire on the eve of Tet, but they had their regular ceasefire, and then they tunneled under all the installations and set off sectoral charges and blew everything up. And anyway, I was told to get in the ditch and defend my position. Well, I didn't know I had a gun, a rifle, I should say. I was in the motor pool. I was a clerk in the motor pool. And,
I see.
They said, get in the ditch, and you see something coming toward us, you light him up. And then the next thing I know is I'm becoming aware that something's terribly wrong with my body, and it's been 3 months, and I'm at Walter Reed Army Hospital, you know, some 15,000 miles from Vietnam or something like that. So it was quite an experience.
Yes. Well, yeah, it wasn't exactly the handbook you thought you were given when you came in.
No. I volunteered for the draft because I felt guilty about escaping the draft through college. If you were in college back in the late 60s, early 70s, when this Vietnam thing was in full swing, you got drafted if you weren't in school. If you were in school, you got a 2S deferment. Well, I got a 2S deferment, and my best friend and I were just guilt-ridden about it. It's like, you know, our friends and people we know our age, they were being drafted. They were going to Vietnam. A lot of them were dying, and it just wasn't right. It wasn't that I was this patriot or anything like that. It was just it wasn't right.
Right.
And, so we decided to volunteer and get it over with, because eventually it would come around to us eventually. But we wanted to do it sooner than later, so we volunteered for the draft, and we went in on the buddy plan. And we were together for the first 9 months of our military service. And then he got orders for Germany, and I got orders for Vietnam. And that
was
quite interesting, because on the buddy plan, you're supposed to be together. So
yeah.
My best friend, Dan Terry, actually, Dan says, well, let's go talk to the commandant. We'll get this straightened out. We're not supposed to be split up. We're supposed to be together. I said, yeah, right, buddy. So
yeah.
We went to the commandant's office, commandant of the we were in chemical school, by the way. That's another long part of the story. But anyway, so we went to the colonel, commandant of the chemical school, and he was willing to see us. I don't understand how that happened. But anyway, so we Dan's doing all the talking, and I'm just sitting there listening, being a part of it. And he said, you know, we're on the buddy plan, and we're supposed to be together. So, you know, I've got orders for Germany, and he's got orders for Vietnam, and we got to be together, so you got to send me to Vietnam with him.
Oh, no. Wasn't it supposed to go
the
other way?
He got a big kick out of it. He said,
oh,
no,
my
son,
God.
That's not the way it works. You're going to go to Vietnam, and you're going to go to Germany, and that's all there is to it. So that was all there was to it. So I went to Vietnam, and my best friend went to Germany.
Mm. God.
And in Vietnam, I had an infantry MOS. MOS stands for military occupational status. I had a primary MOS of infantry and a secondary of chemical. I was a chemical decontamination specialist. That meant
if
they drop the atomic bomb or we get hit with chemical warfare or whatever, I'm supposed to be able to decontaminate all the people and the vehicles and stuff like that. It was, anyway, much to do about nothing. So I get there, and it's a rude awakening, and all of these bombs and bullets and all of the noise of war. It was quite unsettling, but, I adapted quite easily, and actually I had a lot of enjoyment from when I was in Vietnam. I wasn't snooping and pooping in the bush with a rifle trying to kill the enemy. I didn't do that. I was in the motor pool, and I was the PLL clerk. PLL stands for Prescribed Load List. I ordered all the parts for all the vehicles so the mechanics could repair and upgrade the vehicles as they came in from the field. So I had a great job, and it was quite safe. I was in Long Bend, which had an off General William Westmoreland, the supreme commander of the services in Vietnam. He had an office there, so you can figure, you know, if William Westmoreland has an office in Long Bend, it's going to be pretty safe. But I found out nothing was safe in Vietnam. You don't escape the horrors of war just because you're in a place that's supposed to be safe. It didn't quite work that way, but I enjoyed it up to that point.
Well, I think they're learning that in this war as well. You know, I was talking to my guest, I believe it was last week, and I didn't know this about him. He had a recent traumatic brain injury in a car accident, but he's someone I've known a long time, and I knew that he had been in Vietnam, and I was asking him about Rolling Thunder, and I was talking about the motorcycles that go on the pilgrimage to the Washington Monument, and he said, well, he had never been to that because he was at the real Rolling Thunder in Nam, and we talked about that, and what little I've heard from my Uncle Tony, who was there, not a good place to be. It sounds like we maybe should have learned that first time about people who burrow and figured out that they do this in our new theater also.
Absolutely. Yeah, traumatic brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder, 60% of soldiers returning from war in Afghanistan and Iraq have some form of post-traumatic stress disorder or a traumatic brain injury. 60%. That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that it's because they're taking note of that? How different might it have been in your mind as you reflect back in the war that you were?
Well, first off, I had no idea what traumatic brain injury was. I didn't know anything about it until maybe I'd been back for about 25 or 30 years. See, post-traumatic stress disorder it's nasty. It conjures up all of these horrors that you'd experienced. You've seen all of these people dying, and the trauma of war is not pretty. So all of these things stick in your subconscious, and then they raise their ugly head when you least expect it. I mean, when you're in the drugstore to buy something from the druggist, get a prescription refilled, and somebody drops something and there's a loud crash, and all of a sudden you're back in Vietnam and the memories of these events that happened just come up, and it's hard to control in an environment like that. You do and say things and act out, and I never hurt anybody. I never thought about anything like that. I would cry a lot.
Right. And I'm sure get the jumps when something like that happened, even, you know, like 4th of July. I thought about that a lot this year. I did a show around that period of time, and aside from the fact that I think they should keep them at organized events where people know what they're doing, because so many people get hurt every year, you know, it also affects the pets. And now we've been having war for quite a while, and I've heard the statistics of the troops coming home with PTSD, and it just doesn't seem like, you know, I don't know what it's like where you live, but they get 10 days here to celebrate one day, and it's legal, meaning they can buy the fireworks and be shooting them off for 10 days just to celebrate that one day, 4th of July, right? So,
I've never been a big fireworks person. I don't enjoy going to a fireworks display. I will watch it on television. But anyway, it doesn't bother me now. I've got over it, and I'll tell you how I got over it is meditation. I've been meditating for 38 years, every day, morning and night. Morning when I get up, at night before I go to bed, I meditate, and in between I'll meditate two or three other times just when I have the time. Now, meditation, what it does is it cleans out all of that subconscious stuff that you've acquired over a lifetime. Meditation cleanses it out. It's like a filter. It causes it to it doesn't go away. The horrors that I experienced and saw are still there, but they're in the background. They're not at the forefront. They're not at the forefront of my subconsciousness or my memory. They're just in there, and I can call them up, but I don't have to, and I don't want to. That's what meditation has done for me, is it has allowed me to live a normal life as opposed to being squeamish and not wanting to go around to VA hospitals. Yeah, I didn't go to the VA hospital for 30 years because I didn't want to be exposed to other soldiers. It would bring back the memories that I didn't want to live through. So I didn't go to the VA for many years. I just started going to the VA again about 10 years ago. So the VA is wonderful. It gets a lot of bad press about how it's not very, the doctors are not good. No. Doctors are fabulous. It's just the staff that makes the appointments, and the staff can be a lot better. But, you know, it's the human condition. It is what it is. But the VA hospitals are wonderful, and I've received hundreds of thousands, maybe $1 million worth of treatment over the last 43 years. Hmm. So the VA does a wonderful job, and they shouldn't get the bad rap that they do.
Now, a lot of people, though, whatever kind of luck they've had, good luck or bad luck, going through the VA, have pretty much gotten treated in the past with traditional forms of treatment, medication, physical therapy, psychoanalysis, things like that, to varying degrees of help. What made you, what turned you on to, one of the reasons why, and I say that I'm one of the luckiest hosts, we all are here at Brain Injury Radio, because we can look around for guests to have on our show and find people that are appealing to us for one reason or another. And when I was reading about you, I thought, you know, we have a few hosts, former military hosts on this show, and a lot of wounded warriors who listen to this show. And one of my thoughts was, it came to my mind, and I know you won't take offense because I'm going to go right past this remark, but do you remember an old saying, real men don't eat quiche?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, now there's some people out there who might be tough, and as you were in a tough place in war, who wouldn't even consider or imagine that something like yoga and meditation would be a tool that they would turn to. They would think of that as being something more that women do, and kind of poo-poo that off. I wanted you to come on because I know better, and also to help spread that word. You're a perfect person to spread that word, a much better person than I would be to talk about how meditation has helped with my PTSD and my brain injury, but to hear it from someone who's served in a terrible war and has got such a track record with it being a tool that works. What brought you there in the first place to meditation?
Well, when I came to California, I got my discharge from the Army in 69. I went home. I lived in Atlanta, Georgia. I went to school at Georgia State University, got a degree, and I had connections to get a good job in California. My uncle got me a job, so I immediately went to California. And in California, I met Shad Meshad. Shad is the founder and president of the National Veterans Foundation, but at the VA, he was a psychologist who worked specially with veterans, Vietnam veterans, at the VA here in Los Angeles. And we worked out together at Jack LaLanne's European Health Spa, so we became fast friends. And he was, as a psychologist, a therapist at the VA, he was always trying to pull me into his Vietnam veteran groups, and I resisted it because of the PTSD that I had. I didn't want to get around any of it, so I stayed away from it for years. And then what brought me to it was that I had also started a new business. I was in the computer services business. We started a data processing company, and it was quite successful. And there was a lot of stress of trying to do the right thing, starting a new business, and keeping this PTSD at bay. It was stressful. It was very stressful. Well,
yes.
In the early 70s, the Beatles were extremely popular, as you well know. And George Harrison, the guitarist of the Beatles, he was a very spiritual man. He went to India, and he met with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was the creator of transcendental meditation. And he started these centers all around the country, centers around the country. There was a transcendental meditation center in Westwood, and they had a free seminar at the Santa Monica Civic one night, and I went because I heard, I believe it was from Shad, that if you meditate, it will release a lot of the problems that you have, all this built-up anxieties and tension and memories. And he didn't understand that I had PTSD at the time, actually. But he knew that I needed to release stress and, you know, the stress that I had for my business as well as the PTSD stress. So he suggested, you know, I probably ought to go to this session at the Santa Monica Civic about meditation. And I went, and I really liked what I was hearing about, you know, this thing called meditation. And I immediately went to the Westwood Center and signed up. I believe it was a couple hundred dollars, maybe $250 or $300 to get a mantra. A mantra is a sound. It's not really a sound. It's a thought. It's kind of hard to describe, but it's this sound, this thought that you have when you sit and you get quiet. You sit in a comfortable chair, comfortable position, and you close your eyes and you think this thought. It's not, like I said, it's not really thinking. It's you allow this thought to enter your mind, and you focus on that thought. And you do this for 20 minutes. So I was a transcendental meditation person for 20-some-odd years, and then when I joined the Agape International Spiritual Center, I started meditating in another way, and that was just on the breath. Just, you get quiet and you sit with your eyes closed and you focus on your breath. The inflow and the inflow and the outflow of your breath through your nostrils. You just focus on that inflow and the outflow, and you don't think about things. It's natural to think about what you did during the day. It's natural to think about the problems you might have with your family, the problems that you might have at work. There's all sorts of things that will come up. Well, they come up and they will leave if you allow them, but you don't focus in on those problems that you have. So you sit quietly and you think your mantra, and if these thoughts come in and you just can't get over the thoughts, you go back. You go back and you focus on the mantra. Or in the case that I meditate now, I focus on the breath. So, I mean, I just get quiet and listen, and I focus on my breath, and it's fabulous what it does for you. It releases stress. You become quiet. Now, as far as traumatic brain injury, what it does for traumatic brain injuries, your brain controls your entire body. Everything you do is controlled by this magnificent brain. And when your brain has been damaged through a traumatic brain injury, there's a lot of things going on with the brain that's not functioning quite right. And the right side of your body controls the left side. The right side of your brain controls the left side of your body. Left side of your brain controls the right side of your body. I had a terrific contusion. Couldn't think of the word. I had a contusion of the right temple area of my brain, which caused my brain to swell uncontrollably inside my cranium. And if I had got to a doctor quickly, I would have died from the pressure on my brain inside my, because of all the swelling, blood loss, and the swelling inside my brain, inside my cranium, rather. I was about to die. But luckily for me, they took me to the 24th Evac Hospital, where there was this fine neurosurgeon. He was on staff, on hand, and he triaged me. He took me immediately to surgery, and he drilled holes in my head. Now, this was new. They didn't know, the Army Medical Corps, the doctors in the hospitals in Vietnam, they didn't really know a whole lot about it, traumatic brain injuries.
Right.
He had heard about it and read up on it, and he knew that he had to release that strength. So he drilled holes in my skull, and I've got pictures of this, and it is, I can't believe that he drilled a hole. I mean, you've seen these old-fashioned drills where their hand goes around and around and around, drilling, and it's drilling motion.
Yep.
And he's drilling a hole in my head with this drill, this manual drill that goes, he's going around and around, cranking this thing. And he did a good job. I think I had four or six smaller burr holes, what they call burr holes, around
right.
the edges of my skull. And then I had a larger decompression, what they call a decompression. It was about the size of a dime in my temple area where the contusion was. And this released all of this stress. And, well, not really. Well, it released the stress and the pressure. The pressure.
The pressure, yeah.
Pressure from the blood loss and the swelling. It just, it went away. And, I lived, and I was available to do what I needed to do. But the first thing I tried to do was get up and walk to the bathroom.
How'd that go?
I couldn't use my left leg. Nothing on the left side of my body worked. The right side worked. So I thought, I can do this. Now, see, that's another thing. I know that I have the ability to do whatever I want to do. I've always known this. I don't know why, but since I was a young child, I always believed I could do anything I wanted. It was just something that I knew. I don't know why I knew
that.
So
you had you were imprinted with a determination.
Right. Exactly. So knowing that I could do anything, I knew that I could make my body work again. It's just something I knew. Well, so I started trying, and that was to walk to the bathroom. So I, in a great deal of pain and a lot of effort to get to the side of bed and try to stand up, it took me a long time to just get to the side of the bed. And then when I did and I stood up or tried to stand up, I immediately fell and knocked over tables and chairs and glasses breaking and all sorts of stuff. And the doctors and nurses came running in. Well, what in the world are you doing? You can't do this. You can't walk. You're paralyzed. Just get back in the bed. We'll take care of you. What do you want?
Oh, my.
It's like, no, you've done your job. You did your job. You did the surgery. You did the medication. You did the therapies. You did your job. I got to do my job. And my job was to try as hard as I could. See, that's the thing. A lot of people don't try. They want the doctors to fix them. They want the doctors to do whatever they do to make them whole and complete again. Well, it doesn't quite work that way. You got to do your part, and your part is to believe you can do it. If you don't believe you can overcome this situation, it's never going to happen. It's just not miracles. Snap your fingers and it goes away. Yes, some people with traumatic brain injuries, they recover in time without a lot of this stuff I'm talking about. They don't have to meditate. They don't have to have surgeries and not. They just recover. And the brain is very, very complex. It's very complicated. It needs a lot of loving care, and you need to help it heal. So that's when I say I was unconscious for 3 months. I was unconscious for a lot of that time because they kept me in an induced coma so my brain would heal. One of the things that I don't remember a whole lot of any of it, but one of the things I remembered was that when I was in after I was treated in Vietnam, and they drilled the holes in my head and released the pressure, they sent me to Okinawa. And in Okinawa, they were pumping me full of morphine and everything. I was in a lot of pain. So I kept asking, give me one more shot. Give me another shot. Give me another shot. I was turning into a junkie. And not really, but I mean, I kept wanting more morphine. Give me more morphine. And they say, no, you can't do that. We're not going to do that. So I kept asking. And one of the orderlies, he just got tired of me hollering for more shot. Give me another shot. He got tired of it. So he rolled me in a linen closet, locked the door. I'm in a linen closet in a wheelchair, and I can't get out. And I was furious. I was furious. So my right side of my body worked. And I hooked my right leg in the rack of the linen, in the linen closet with a rack of all the linens. I hooked my leg in the linen rack, and I pulled it toward me, and all of the linen crashed down on top of me. And this orderly came running in. What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? He was so mad, he hit me in the head. I was out, boom, gone. That's the last thing I remember about being in the hospital. In this case, is Okinawa, shortly after being in Vietnam. So he knocked me out, and that could have very well killed me. But the next thing I remember was I was getting off the plane in Walter Reed Army Hospital, and wheeling into the my parents were there, and they wheeled me into this room and put me in the bed. And all this time, I don't know what's wrong. Something's wrong with my body, but I just didn't understand the complicated mess I was in. And I learned quickly after I got into Walter Reed, and they put me in a special unit just for paraplegics and people with brain injuries. So I just knew I could overcome this. It was this knowing that I'd always had, and I just believed it, and I did whatever I could do to make it work. So, see, there's this. I don't know why I knew this, but there's this life force all around us, all around me, and I believed that I could focus my energy on this life force, and I could focus it on my body that wasn't working. So I focused this force into my legs and my arm, the left side of my body that didn't work. And eventually, I could stand up. And when I stood up, doctor walked in the room and said, whoa, look at this. This is a miracle. This guy was paralyzed yesterday, and now he's standing up and shuffling around. Look at this. Wow, what a miracle. I said, no, doc, this is not a miracle. It's what I know I could do. I just knew I could do this, and I did it. There's no miracle. So anyway, my message is that regardless of what you think about your brain injury, if you believe in yourself, that's the key. The key is believing in yourself. Within yourself is everything you need to do whatever you want. I believe that. I know that. I have a lot of friends that have overcome greater disabilities than I have had. One gentleman is a good friend of mine. I just saw him about an hour ago. His name is Idris Hester. He's a Congo player. Congas, not Congo. Congas, he plays the congas. That's bongos for those who don't know what a conga is. Anyway, he's had four brain surgeries, for cancer of the brain. He had four tumors on his brain, cancerous, and he should be dead now if he had listened to the doctors, you know, oh, you got to do this or you're going to die. Well, he's had a lot of surgeries, brain tumors, and he's still alive because he knew he could overcome this. Yeah, he saw a lot of different doctors, and he took that information he gathered, and he did what was best for him, and he knew he could overcome this. So he did that. I've got a lot of examples of people that have overcome greater adversities than me, and it's just a matter of knowing that you can do these things. See, so many of us just don't believe in ourselves. We don't believe that we can do these things. We've been taught throughout our life from our teachers, our parents maybe, you know, well-meaning individuals that say, under this circumstances, you know, this is just bad. You're just not going to be able to get over this. And that sticks in your subconscious, and you begin to believe it. And then when things happen, you believe that you're not going to get over this. You believe that you're going to be a paraplegic the rest of your life. You can believe a lot of things that are not the truth. The truth is you can overcome way more than you think you can. If you believe it, you can achieve it. Sorry, I got off on a tangent there. Kim, are you still there?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I got you. I thought I lost the connection there.
No, I lost my connection. I'm sorry about that. The audience will get a laugh about that. What I was going to say is that while some people don't have the confidence that they're going to be able to make it through this trial, I can't tell you how many people I've heard I'll call myself an observing host and include myself in the numbers of people who we don't remember because, you know, with the ding to the head, you don't know if you're on foot or horseback, but our families have been told that chances are we weren't going to make it. And if we did, you know, we were going to have a big fat mess, and the most improvement that we would make would in the first year. These were the old stories, and so it wasn't just alone. I think, you know, there's a couple things come into play, and I want you to address this. I know that you do, but just going back for the audience a little, because, you know, I do understand that, you know, we might have been confident people who felt really determined, but when something happens at a particularly, you know, at a young, out of the blue age like that, that's a game changer for the rest of your life, you know, it does shake the confidence factor a little bit. And even if you're a really determined person, we're out of the generation like our grandparents who thought that the doctor's word was gospel and they were God. And I think we're a little bit more open-minded now. But, you know, as far as like even the government goes, the AMA, you know, there's too much money in the pharmaceutical industry right now to let people do like free things like have hyperbaric chamber treatments or go to meditation classes or, you know, get any of a number of alternative treatments. They don't pay for those. And so it makes it hard. You know, people have to have some money to go pay $70-$80 an hour for enough of these treatments to make a difference. Now, not with the meditation, and I'm going to let you go on with your story, but if anybody had any confidence shaken and doubt within themselves, the doctor sure don't help 98% of the people I hear here, that's for sure. If everybody, in fact, if everybody who is a host now on this show, which is, I think we got about 15 of us now, and most of us, our families, were told we were toast. Truly, if we would have believed that, we wouldn't be here now. But there was a real struggle in the beginning, and even sometimes when, you know, we have a relapse of residuals, our whatever residuals we were left with, that, you know, you do keep that fighting determination going, and it is something that you have to draw out from within, because you get enabled by family members, friends, doctors, support groups, a lot of things like that will enable you to keep you down. One of the things one of the hosts on here says a lot is, we don't want to hand out, we want to hand up. Well, a lot of times, you know, we've gotten a hand down. And so I think what you have to say is extremely valid. I just didn't know if you knew how widespread with civilians and veterans alike that, you know, they've had a little help with their determination being undermined by traditional medicine in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate to have my VA benefits. I couldn't have made it this far without it. In fact, when I was being discharged from the Army, I got a medical discharge, I waived my benefits, because what I wanted to do was go back to school. I was at Fort McClellan, Alabama, in the Army, after my brain injury and return from Vietnam. I was stationed at Fort McClellan, Alabama, in the one of the units there. And the college that I went to before I was drafted was just down the street at Jacksonville State University. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go back to school. That's all I could think of, is I want to go back to school, I want to go back to school, I don't want to be here in the Army, I want to go back to school. So as they were processing my medical discharge, the next semester was about to start, and it was clear that the Army was not going to finish my discharge papers in time.
Mm.
So my father had a connection with Senator Herman Talmadge. I don't know if you remember that name, but Senator Herman Talmadge was the senator from Georgia, and he was very powerful. He was the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee.
Okay.
The Appropriations Committee is the committee that funds the military. So he had a lot of pull. Whatever Senator Herman Talmadge said, he got. So I knew that my father could do something about my situation. And when I came back, they stuck me in the motor pool again. And the old first, we had a first sergeant who was determined that I was a shucker, that this profile, when you have a problem physically in the Army, they give you what they call a profile. A profile is something that says, you know, you can't do this, you shouldn't do that, so you don't have to do a lot of duty. You don't have to go to KP, you don't have to do CQ, you don't have to do a lot of stuff that you normally do in the Army. Mm-hmm. But this old first sergeant, he just knew I was a shucker. And he says, he sent me on duty that I didn't have to do. I mean, I had a profile a mile long, and I didn't have to do a lot of the stuff, and because I didn't have to do it, I didn't do it. And the old first sergeant was just ignored, aggravated with me, rather. And he put me on a lot of different duties, like KP and fire watch, all kind of stupid things just to aggravate me. So I called my mother, and I said, get in touch with Senator Talmadge. Get him out here. Get these people off my back. You know, I need some help.
Yeah. Well, did he not get a report that said you had all these burr holes in your
head?
Yes,
of course. But still, I mean, See, I could walk around. I had a limp, but I could walk around. I could use my body. And, you know, for the uninitiated, I looked perfectly whole, complete. There was nothing
there
wrong
you go.
With me, seemingly, other than the limp I had. And
right.
He just knew I was just making this stuff up. So he's put me on all this duty. And I called my mom, and I told her to get Dad to call Senator Talmadge and get them off my case. So, boy, does it roll down fast. I tell you what, Senator Talmadge called the general of the fort, the commanding officer for Fort McClellan, a general, a lieutenant general, that's a four-star. And he called him up and said, you know, you got to treat this, my constituent, Mr. William Roper, he's in this unit over here, and you're just missing, your men are mistreating him, and I want you to get off of his case. Leave him alone. He doesn't have to do this stuff. He's a war hero. I want you to treat him like that. So one day I'm in the motor pool. Little shave-tail second lieutenant comes running down to the motor pool where I am, and he says, Roper, we got to get back up to the office. Colonel needs to see you. And so, okay, all right. So we're going along, and he's trying to rush me, and so I start trying to run. And I'm not running very well because I got this problem with
limp.
My left side, this
yeah.
residual weakness in my left side. So I'm trying to run, and he said, "Whoa, whoa, Roper, don't do that. You can just walk. We can get there. Just take your time, but let's hurry a little bit. You don't need to run. Take your time." So we get back to the colonel, and he meet with the colonel, and says, "Roper, I understand that we're mistreating you."
Anyway,
I go through this long thing. He says, "What do you want?" And I said, well, I want to go back to school, but my medical discharge is holding me up. I went to school down the street here at Jacksonville State, and I want to go back because the spring semester is about to start, and I need to go in and enroll. And the colonel says, Roper, you can do anything you want. Just, okay, go back to school. I said, sir, but I'm in the Army here. Don't worry about that. Just go enroll in school and do whatever you... So I went back to school. I'm in the Army, but I got an apartment, and I was in school at Jacksonville State University, and I was in biology class or something. I'm not sure what class I was in. But a runner from the dean's office came down and says, you need to get back to Fort McClellan. They got your discharge papers ready. So I go down to Fort McClellan to get my discharge papers. And the old first sergeant, I had to go to my unit first. And the old first sergeant, I had let my hair grow a little bit. It wasn't anything like a hippie or anything. It was just, you know, kind of hung over my ears a little bit. First sergeant had a fit. We're not going to get your discharge papers until you get a haircut.
Oh, God.
So I had to go get a haircut before I would get my discharge papers, and I did. But the discharge papers, I had to waive my benefits because they were taking such a long time with this. I just wasn't going to be able to get into the spring semester at Jacksonville State. So I said, look, what can I do? I need to go to school. I need to get out and go to school. And they said, okay, well, the only way you can get out is to sign this release.
Oh,
so I said,
no.
I'll sign whatever you want. So he gave me a piece of paper, and I signed it. He said, okay, here's your discharge papers. So I was out. Well, what I signed was a release for my benefits. I got no benefits.
That's insane.
No benefits. So I was fine with that, but when I got home, my father had been in Korea, the Korean War, and World War II, and he was in Patton's Third Army in World War II, and he had PTSD because he was in the Battle of the Bulge where there were thousands of people killed, and he had a rough time dealing with that. So he knew I was going to need those benefits, and so he encouraged me to go down to the VA and get my benefits reinstated. Which I did, and I'm so glad I did. But
yes,
yeah.
What a dirty trick to try to pull like that. I mean, how old would you have been when they were pulling that sleight of hand?
I was 23.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. Obviously, you're young. You're that desperate to get out, go to school, and to pull such a amazing.
Yeah, well, that was typical of what the military did back then. I don't believe they're that way anymore. But, I mean, you know, they were looking to save money, and they were looking to, you know, do whatever's best for the Army. And, you know, they didn't care about me. And that was clear, but I didn't care about them, and I wanted out. I didn't care how it happened. They'd just get me out. And
yeah.
I did. I got out, but I didn't have any benefits. so thankful that my father encouraged me. He took me down to the VA and got me all signed up. So
now, when you were in school and your father had this foresight because of his own experience, at that point, had you been diagnosed with PTSD,
no.
Or you were just were you experiencing symptoms?
I didn't
symptoms?
Know anything about PTSD. It was not anything like it is now. I mean, it's on the news. It's everywhere. Everybody knows what PTSD is now and what causes it. But back then, nobody knew anything about PTSD.
Seemed like that was another war where they kind of missed out, because it was shell shock in World War II. Then you didn't hear about it in Nam.
Right.
And, you know, you're right. And now we've skipped to these wars, and we know all about knowing more about traumatic brain injury and PTSD, but they really hadn't had the transitional labels for them in Nam. Okay, so you started school, and did you start exhibiting symptoms? At what point were you starting to have symptoms, nightmares?
I had visions, and I had problems dealing with it, but I didn't think about it being PTSD or anything like that. I was going back to school, and give you an example of what best friends are. My friend who volunteered for the draft with me, he went to Germany, I went to Vietnam. He's in Germany. I'm in college, still in the military, but I'm in college. And I sent him a letter about, you know, you got to come back and go to college with me. He still had 3 or 4 months to go, so he got an early discharge to come back to go to school with me. And we're in school at Jacksonville State University, and his girlfriend, who would be his wife in a few years, she wanted him to go to University of Georgia with her.
Oh.
He wouldn't do that. He came back to go to school with me because we were best friends. And we had been through so much together, and he knew the problems I was having. And he wanted to be there for me. So that's my best friend story. I got actually a better story than that, but we won't get into that.
About your best friend?
Right.
Did he get to keep that? Well, you said that she became his wife, so even though he didn't follow her off to school, apparently they found a way to work that out.
Yeah, he went. After the first semester we went through at Georgia, Jacksonville State, I went back and went to school at Georgia State in Atlanta, Georgia, and he went to Athens, Georgia, to University of Georgia with his girlfriend.
I see. And had you been married at the time?
No. I never got married until, 1984. I was married for 10 years to 94.
So in the meantime, you were on your own. You said you were in a career and that the career was stressful, and that's when you took up the meditation and some of these practices, but you also at that point had not been diagnosed with an underlying PTSD just from the experience you had, not only in the war, but, you know, as somebody who got my bean cracked, and by the time mine came along, they had power tools. So it was the saw, not the crank like you had. But, you know, that's a pretty traumatic thing, you know, to think about happening to you, reading details about it and waking up and finding that you're that way, you know, that you have that dent and in my case, a notch, a dent, and I called it zipper head back at the time. But so you're not really diagnosed at this point, but you must be having some problems. And were you just taking them as isolated problems because there wasn't a name that would bundle a group of symptoms at that time, like PTSD? They didn't resurrect shell shock?
No, I didn't. I just avoided. See, that's the primary way that soldiers returning from war, regardless of whether it was the First World War, Second World War, Korea, or Vietnam, you don't want to talk about it. You just don't want to talk about it because it brings up all of these memories. And everybody that goes through war, if you go through war and you see all of this, there's a certain amount of PTSD that's lying in wait. But I didn't know that. I didn't know that I had this problem called PTSD. It was an unknown. It wasn't something that was out in the forefront. I went to the VA hospital because my father took me there when I lost my mind. I didn't know who I was. This is real. I was in college, and one day I just didn't know who I was. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. Somehow, by remote control, I got home. I drove home from downtown Atlanta. I got home. I walked into my bedroom, and I slept for like 3 days. And my mother came in after about 3 days of lying in bed. What are you going to do, sleep your life away? What's going on here? I had no idea who she was.
Hmm.
I didn't know who
you
she
really
was.
Did
I didn't
lose
know
it.
Where I was. And she knew I had a problem. So
right.
She got my father to take me down to the VA hospital. And I sat in the VA hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, for, I don't know, almost all day, waiting for doctors to see me. I saw several doctors who had no idea what to do for me. And the last doctor I saw, I said, "You need to see the doctor." The doctor was a psychiatrist.
Uh-oh.
So the psychiatrist, he gave me a lot, he asked me a lot of questions, and he figured out, you know, there was a traumatic brain injury and it's causing these problems, and he needed to prescribe certain medications, and I needed to rest. So just told my father to take me home and just let me rest and take this medication, and he'll be fine. And I did. I went home, and I had a little dog, a little long-haired dachshund.
Aww.
And me and Ralph were a pair. We were
Ralph.
Ralph and I were together the whole time. We were sitting out on the back patio in a lounge chair. Ralph was in my lap. I didn't know anything. I had no memory of where I was, who I was, what Ralph was. I didn't know anything. And that's strange not to know anything.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, it was just like snapping my finger, it came back. And I could remember not remembering. Now, that's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Remembering, you couldn't remember. But anyway, it was a byproduct of the traumatic brain injury.
Right. We had somebody on our show, and I wish that I would be able to remember better from my own, but he was giving definitions for different types of amnesia, and that sounds kind of like what one of his descriptions was, but of course we wouldn't know it. And then the other thing, now I got through my episode with a short-haired dachshund named Frank Furter. So a wiener dog is definitely something you want to check into along with therapy.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're in recovery out there, folks, nothing like a loving wiener dog. They are loyal to a fault and will defend you fiercely to the end if need be, but mostly they like to just cuddle under the covers.
But Ralph didn't smell real good, and so as a result of me hanging out with Ralph all the time, I smelled like we smelled the same, which wasn't good. So that was when I could remember, when it just snapped, came back, I could remember everything. The first thing I it came in my mind is, damn, Ralph, we got to take a bath. We smell bad, Ralph. So I went in, took a shower, and Ralph showered with me. And that was that.
So do you know about how long this amnesia or breakdown or just blank blackout lasted for you?
A couple of weeks. It was toward the, and I was worried about whether I'd graduate. I was a senior at Georgia State University, and I was about to graduate, and I needed to pass this one class, and I was on the edge. I didn't have a lot of good grades, and I needed that class to graduate. And the day of graduation, I didn't know if I was going to graduate, but I went to the ceremony, and my family was there, and I got no idea if I'm going to graduate or not, but I went up to the stage with everybody else, and they called my name and gave me a diploma, so I graduated.
You did it.
I really thought I might not, because being on, you know, not knowing anything for that few weeks, I missed a lot of class, and I just didn't know if what I had done up to that point was going to be enough to pass.
Well, it's a good thing you had that unwavering determination, because you probably beat it, you know, in the first 3.5 years, so you could afford to have a breakdown at the end of that time and still be able to pick up your diploma at the end.
Right.
What a scary thing.
But, you know, going back to, I just believed in myself. I believed I could do these things. I never doubted anything. I had a positive outlook on life. I believed I could overcome this, and I did. And I believe I'm no different than you, than anybody else out there. I believe we all have this amazing ability if we disbelieve it and we try. And sure, some of us will try and not succeed. Somebody with a traumatic brain injury won't be able to speak as well as they want. But if they do the speech therapy and they do everything the doctors tell them, they might not be able to speak like they could before the traumatic brain injury, but they'll be able to speak and they'll be able to communicate. So you might not be able to recover from your traumatic brain injury 100% back to what you were.
Right.
Like, I haven't recovered to this day 100% of what I was before my traumatic brain injury, but I've recovered to the point of, like, 95%. I still got 5% out there that, you know, it's just what it is, and I live with it, and, you know, I'm 95%, and that's good enough.
Yeah, that's darn good. By a certain age, I think we start getting that way on our own. But don't you? Like, is memory, what kind of, what's your few percent you have left? For me, it's short-term memory problems, those can get kind of embarrassing. You got any of that?
Oh, of course. Yeah. And see, I'm a professional speaker. And as a speaker, it's very embarrassing to be on the stage talking to a bunch of people about something, and I lose my place, and I can't remember what I'm supposed to say next. And that's not very good. So far, I've been able to ad-lib through it. I mean, I know when I'm not right, when I'm not saying what I'm supposed to say. I know
right.
that, but the audience, they don't know it. I can cover
right.
it up well enough to get by, but it's quite distressing to not remember what I'm supposed to do.
It is distressing, but one of the things that you just said about that the others don't know and that you can cover it, you know, another problem people have in back of that kind of thing is an anxiety that outs them. But I think you bring up a good point that while you can feel a response internally, you know, you can move through it personally. You didn't know it, but a while ago when you couldn't hear me, the people who listen to my show regularly know that a habit I have is muting my mic if there's going to be some noise. We live, well, you being in the military, we live in the flight pattern for STRATCOM, the Strategic Air Command, SAC, here in the Midwest, and some of those planes come down big and loud and low, and so I'll mute my microphone, and I have a saying called something shiny, you know, something you said or something I catch out of the corner of my eye, and it takes my mind off the track, and then I forget to unmute my mic, and which I did with you a few minutes ago, and I could have let you think it was a problem on your end, but my audience knows better at this time that's something I forget, and you know, I do it, though. In difference, I will defend myself a little and say that they usually catch me doing it at least once a show, but I'm probably muting my mic maybe 15 times a show, so yeah, it does get embarrassing whether you're talking on radio because, see, I can't ad-lib when I'm muted.
Oh, no.
So you've been out speaking about what is your message? Again, I don't want you to go through, go through your book, but as far as the message, having determination and confidence in yourself to take yourself to heights that were perhaps counter-predicted, in a traditional medical community, and that meditation is not something guys can't do like eat quiche. It's actually something that's cleansing and kind of like dumping out the psychological trash. I know when I first started meditating that I couldn't clear my head long enough to get that focal point. And I had been a dancer when I was young, so I was thinking of along the lines of focal point. And where I went was focusing on the breath, like you're talking about breath exercises, because you pretty well have to, you know, focus on your breath, and that helps block and chase out some of that toxicity that's not supposed to be there. And then as you bring in the clean oxygen, can exhale some of the toxic thoughts. But one of the things that I've found helpful for me while I'm doing that, if breathing alone doesn't do it, is by lighting a candle and putting it in front of me. And then I have a focal point, which is not the top of the flame, but the blue part at the top of the wick, at the bottom of the flame. And if while I'm breathing, I can use that as a focal point. It was really kind of freaky the first couple times it happened, but now it's really comforting, is that I'll be in a room, and of course when I sit down, I have all the awareness of what's going on in my head. I have the awareness of the room and how it's positioned and what's in there. And then when I sit down and I get in the zone, we'll say, start that breathing and light that candle and just focus on that focal point, it does, I don't know how long it takes, but it doesn't take very long, and the room becomes completely black. There's nothing there anymore. It's just me and space and breath. Purged of those thoughts. And I think that, you know, the, like I say, the breathing helps me. And then having a focal point where you're forced, you know, a lot of people, well, as you know, a lot of people with brain injuries and PTSD, any combination thereof, have problems with impulse control, anger, you know, like we were talking about, the nightmares, sometimes attitudinal problems, and to be able to fight that or to put some balance on the scales, I just think it's really productive. At least it has been for me. Like you say, some things never go away, but they're not on the front burner anymore, because I've breathed and believed, I guess, you know, that this was a possibility to do it this way and to still leave that life force intact that you were talking about. And I'm not at all advocating that people don't take medication or anything like that that has been suggested by the doctor. But if a person solely relies on that and believes that that's going to be the only answer, I think they're probably in a large percentage going to have a rude awakening, because a lot of that, well, the way I would term it is blocks the light of the spirit, because you're so, they flatten your affect, and that's hard to feel the vibrance of a life force when you're chemically having your affect flattened.
Wow. Yeah.
But
so we were talking the other day about the foundation that got meditation approved at the VA. It's in Pasadena,
yes.
And it's called the David Lynch Foundation.
Okay, I'm gonna...
it's in Pasadena. But the David Lynch Foundation works with the VA, and the VA has approved meditation as a viable means for treatment for PTSD, as well as traumatic brain injury and so forth. So anyway, the VA has accepted meditation. And like I said, it's called the David Lynch Foundation. And if you were to Google David Lynch Foundation, you could find out more about this. But meditation has been approved as a legitimate treatment for PTSD with the VA.
And I just typed that in there. thank you for repeating it. I also typed it in our chat room. So if anyone didn't catch that, you can always get a hold of me at inaflash.org, or you can get a hold of William Roper. Again, his website is www.tbivet.com. And I think that's great that they've gotten to the point where, you know, that progression has happened, where they are starting to accept some things like meditation, as well as, you know, therapy, psychological therapy, perhaps medication, but also giving more arrows to the quiver, you know, of recovery, because as you alluded to earlier, not everything works for everyone, but if you have a number of things to try, you're going to find the recipe that works best for you, as opposed to giving up and just listening to, you know, what a doctor told you or what a moment of, you know, your confidence being undermined would tell you, and see that you can truly reach some heights you never would have dreamed of. Like when all this was happening to you, and I ask everybody this because, you know, we comment about it as hosts on the show, and you would comment on it as a circuit speaker, but would you have even guessed X amount of years ago that you would be in this position, that you would be out talking to other veterans and civilians, but out talking about the merits of meditation in the recovery of TBI and PTSD from war veterans? Is that something you ever reckoned you'd be doing when you were in college?
No. I became aware of this vision for my life back seven, 8 years ago. I was aware of this vision. This vision was to help veterans who returned from war with the same disabilities that I had. That was PTSD and traumatic brain injury.
Right.
Was the foremost disability that soldiers returned from war in today, I felt compelled to give back. I got through it. You can get through it. Here's how I did it. And I ran up against a lot of brick walls at the VA trying to get them to listen to me and to let me help other veterans. They're very resistant.
Yep.
But anyway, this David Lynch Foundation has been accepted as a has accepted meditation as a treatment, and it's something that I couldn't accomplish because I didn't have
now,
a doctor behind my name.
Right. Yeah. Too often that's what it takes. Now, has part of your meditation ever included the emotional freedom technique, the tapping EFT?
I'm really not familiar with it. I've heard of it, but I'm not familiar with it.
Right. Okay. I was just wondering because it's interesting. I had a guest on, well, and actually he did EMDR. These all stand for something different, but it's interesting that a lot of retired veterans are getting into this particular man, Sergeant Major Pepe Ramirez of the retired United States Marine Corps, is in Colorado, and he has a treatment facility, and they're doing things like the hyperbaric chamber and the EMDR treatments and some other treatments that have not yet gotten approved by the VA. And they are being funded by three organizations, the American Military Family, the Rocky Mountain Hyperbaric Institute, and Project Sanctuary. Not sure if you've heard of any of those, but one of the things that people looking at the program page might see is there's a picture of a flag with a certificate of authenticity on it. And these three flags were used this 4th of July for the 4th of July celebration, I guess you'd call it, in Iraq, and these are being auctioned off to fund those nonprofits that are funding the Sergeant Major's place, and this has enabled him to be able to treat veterans at no charge in a lot of cases, or very little charge for things that wouldn't have been covered under their benefits. And so I really applaud you and people like the Sergeant Major that are out helping. You know, I haven't heard anybody say anything about, you know, bad about the VA. Well, that's not really true. I've heard a few things. I talk about the how of recovery: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I just caught myself on one of those honesty things. But in any case, yes, I've heard a few things, but I think it's really cool. Just like here, we like to think of Brain Injury Radio as a means of peer-to-peer support, and it was something that we saw was tremendously lacking, a huge gaping hole, because there were a lot of associations and alliances out there, and it appeared, again, as the observing host, because I didn't have access to any of these things in my 17 years, they seemed to be specializing in advocacy and awareness, which is great. Somebody has to do it, get the word out. But what I was hearing from callers, our wounded warriors and so forth, is even our, you know, our civilians, people, anybody with PTSD and brain injury had contacted, if they even had one of these facilities near them, which a lot of them didn't and still don't, they would call looking for some form of peer-to-peer support, and they really didn't have information to give out at that time. And so I really like the concept of one survivor reaching out to help another survivor, and that's another one of the reasons I was excited to have you on the show, is because of the effort you put into your book. I know, and we talked a little bit about this earlier, that it was a long time ago when the beginning of our stories happened, but you relive to some extent by pulling all of those memories to the top to write them down, no matter how many years later it is, that it does take an effort. You have to go back and relive the problem to talk about your progression to the things that have been your solutions, and maybe not solutions at 100%, but things that have mitigated the residuals that you've been left with. So I think that's just wonderful. And I want to quickly say, anybody out there in the audience who would have a question or comment for Bill, call into 424-243-9540. Again, 424-243-9540. And again, I want to say that his book has just been released, and congratulations on that. This is William A. Roper, R-O-P-E-R, and the name of this book is called The Compassionate Warrior. You can check out his website, www.tbivet.com. And he is available for speaking engagements, interviews, and book signings. So if you're in California, is that right?
Yes, I'm in Culver City, California, which is on the west side, close to the airport.
So if somebody wanted you to come to another state, you're close to the airport to be able to come.
Yes.
Good. good. Well, that's good. Well, if it's okay with you, I do have a couple of people who have questions or comments for you, and then I will turn you loose. But I so appreciate you sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us tonight. And, you know, being honest in adding more credibility to this practice, you know, that unless somebody was, you know, taking Eastern psychology in college or, you know, something like that, really didn't think that that was a viable alternative for them. And I'm not trying to be discriminatory, but I know that a lot of people, both men and women, have problems in the beginning quieting their mind to be able to meditate. And so we lose some people in that, just that they don't stick around long enough to let the tool work for them. But I think women have been a little bit more open to this until more recently. And, you know, the foundation having this recognized by the VA is just going to be a tremendous help. So, you know, for your part in that and your friend in that, I commend you for giving the folks another tool.
Well, thank you, Kim. I appreciate that.
Great. Okay, I'm going to put on area code 803, and I believe this might be our Southern Gentleman and Tuesday host, Les Paul Morgan. Is that right?
I think it's me. Let me check. I'm playing with you.
Oh, good. You never know when you see a familiar area code. There's other people that live in that state before the besides the one person you know.
Well, you are a very compassionate warrior. I can tell just the way you speak and how you share the stories you've been sharing tonight. And I never served on a battlefield. I was actually posting some stories about my brother Steve. He was actually posed to go to Vietnam when I think it was a week, maybe 10 days before he was supposed to go to Vietnam, and I think it was 1970 or 71, I'm forgetting, and he was in the back of a Volkswagen Beetle, sound asleep, and a large, I think it was something like an Lincoln Continental that was speeding, they estimated between 80 and 90 miles an hour, hit it from behind and flipped it end over end over end over end off the highway. And they said the car was teetering on the edge of a cliff with him laying on the ground, and he broke his back, and he broke just about anything that could be broken. It destroyed his spleen. And he had the kind of spirit you have, though, despite all of that. I mean, he was in a coma for like 2 or 3 months and not expected to live. When he came out of it, they said he would never walk or talk, but he beat all of those obstacles. And I just wanted to share that to say people like you who go around sharing such power and positivity about there are ways to overcome those mountains, and that's what people need to hear so much more of.
Yes.
And I thank you for coming on for that reason there alone. I mean, you told a great story tonight of hope and recovery, really.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, we're all capable of more than we think.
Yes.
We can do much more. So, as you know, you just try. If you try, you can accomplish a lot more.
You sure can. And I just wanted to share that in the 1980s and early, I'd say the late 1970s and 80s, I met a lot of Vietnam veterans. I live near Augusta, Georgia, and there's two VA hospitals. There's a large medical university. There's actually about 7 or 8 major hospitals within a few miles distance. And a lot of the soldiers came to Augusta, Georgia, and to the Army base there. And so I've met many of them that were so heartbroken to come home to a country that didn't want them back then. The way people were treated when Vietnam was over, it was like they were guilty instead of someone else for going and fighting a war during the turmoil of the 60s and 70s. And I met a lot of them. I actually worked with one man that he got fired from the job. I worked for Lowe's, and he got fired because he had PTSD, and he would go out of his mind and have so many problems, and he couldn't drive a truck. And I met several people like that. So do you think I'm going a long way around to get to a question. Do you think that the people of that generation are finally getting the hope and help they need, or is it still hard for people who were serving in Vietnam, or is it a lot better now?
Well, it's better, but they still have this idea that there's no help for them. So I have a friend, the Shad Meshad. He started the National Veterans Foundation, and he's a call-in center. He has toll-free numbers that people with PTSD can call, and his staff can help them. A lot of times, he can get them the treatments they need at the VA. A lot of times he can get them treatments they need at specialized facilities that accept soldiers with problems. And, it's getting better for sure. It's not where it should be. But if you know anybody that has a problem that has returned from war, whether it's been in Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan, it's hard dealing with the horrors of war. It's not easy, and don't let anybody tell you it is. I mean, I told people for years, probably 20 years, that I don't have a problem with this. I don't want to talk about it, but I don't have a problem with it, and just leave me alone. So it's denial. Denial is the way that most soldiers who return from war with PTSD, denial, avoidance. I avoided soldiers.
Yes.
I avoided VA hospitals. I avoided anything that might remind
okay.
me of the war. And whenever that would happen, I would have problems. So it is much better. It's more accepted in our veterans of today's wars. It's more accepted that they have this problem, and that there's treatment available to them. And a lot of them are getting the treatment, but a lot of them aren't. I'm not trying to say that every veteran that returns from war has all the help that they need. I mean, it's there, but getting them to use it is the problem.
And I've seen what you're talking about, because I facilitate two different brain injury support groups, one in Augusta, Georgia, that's not far from our military base, and the next one in Aiken, North Augusta, South Carolina, which is right next to Augusta. And we're constantly seeing a lot of military people come through, and I've seen them fall through the cracks. Even when we're trying to help them, they'll stop coming to the group. You can't contact them. And it's just like there's a missing link. We've got a strong Wounded Warrior Care Project in Augusta, Georgia. And I know people that are involved with that, and they're working hard to get it. But it just seems like there's such a battle to get some of the people the help they need. So I support our troops and our warriors strongly.
Exactly. It's not good. It's bad. And if our soldiers returning with these problems, if they could just accept the fact that they have an issue that needs to be dealt with, if they can accept that and go to one of these facilities and be treated, it's not
right
to be anything that's going to harm them or make them into something that they're not. It's just going to help them deal with this memory issue they have from the horrors that they've experienced.
Yeah.
Well, and acclimating back into it's not their old environment anymore, because they've lived a million lifetimes before going back to their old environment. So for somebody professional to help them maneuver, you know, into their new reality, it's not a lot different than what we talk about on here about there was an old you. And so many people get stuck. When I said those four A's at the beginning, awareness, first you have to become aware that it's an issue. Acceptance, you know, you have to accept that the issue is really there and really real and it isn't going anywhere. And action, take positive action, like what you were talking about, you know, going to the VA, not being in that denial, trying to do positive actions that walk you out of that denial, and then adaptation, being able to settle back, or not settle back, but settle into new skin, and feel reasonably comfortable and create a life worth living. And we lose so many back in the denial stage. And I think the reason is probably the same reasons I hear from civilians, and that's things like guilt and shame. And like you said, just if it, not talking about the elephant in the room, you know, as long as you take yourself out of the environment and to keep the news off, and it's got to be a lot harder to be in denial right now for a lot of the Vietnam vets because the spotlight is so bright on the war going on now and the veterans coming back with PTSD and TBI. Hopefully that's going to make the others more willing when they see that it's not an isolated incident, particularly now. I think more and more, like you, will be stepping up and being honest about those things, and then it doesn't have to be that secret that goes on in a lot of families about a lot of different things, or a lot of people about a lot of different things. And I heard once a wise person say, you're only as sick as your secrets. And, you know, there's a lot of secrets on the surface and under the surface, that it's very helpful if you can work through some of those with a neutral party who's more experienced than you. And it isn't the weak that ask for help. It's the strong and the wise that ask for the help of someone who knows more than they do. And then they can take what they like and leave the rest. But at least they've gotten some information that maybe the thing that saves their life. So
yeah, there's a tremendous number of veterans who are killing themselves. They're dying on the streets.
Right.
Cause of PTSD. I mean, the
yes.
numbers are just astronomical, and it's very sad. But my friend at the National Veterans Foundation, Shad Meshad, his organization is doing some really good work all in Southern California, goes down into San Diego and gets veterans off the streets. Most of the homeless in the Southern California area are veterans.
Yes.
A lot of people wouldn't believe that and don't believe that, but I don't remember the percentage, but a large predominant percentage of people on the streets homeless are veterans.
I do believe that. In fact, that guest I was telling you about earlier, who was at the Real Rolling Thunder, he started an alcohol and treatment center within a homeless shelter, and he himself, as most counselors are in recovery themselves, was a veteran, as are a lot of the homeless people that are there, and I think that's probably true in prisons as well, you know, because people react to the PTSD, the symptoms of the PTSD sometimes without even realizing, you know, what's going on, and people get hurt. But area code 202 has been waiting for quite some time. Area code 202, who do we have with us?
Good evening. Excuse me. Hello, this is Allie. How are you?
Hi, Allie. This is Bill Roper. Did you have a question or comment for him tonight? Isn't he great?
He is awesome, outstanding. I really, excuse me, want to thank you for your service and for your brave-heartedness, your open-mindedness, your accepting the call to spirit to actually give your life and live your life in service to others. I think it's absolutely fantastic, and I want to salute you. And I'm even more struck and surprised, not surprised, but impressed and pleasantly surprised to know that the generation that you hailed from and having, you know, served in the Vietnam War, I mean, it says a lot about mindsets, and it says a lot about your worldview and perhaps having to overcome that division in having access to that which could actually free you and your spirit to live a life that feels like it's worth living. Because I'm thinking for a lot of people, and let me just start out by saying I'm just getting home from a brain injury support group meeting, and I didn't hear the interview, and I chimed in late, but I did want to say a few things just to acknowledge you for all that you are doing and for the difference that you're making in the lives of so many. So, Kim, I'm going to listen to the rebroadcast and catch up that way. But I have an uncle who served in Vietnam, and he was a medic, and he, prior to the war, was a very dapper gentleman, ladies' man, kind of a guy who owned like a club. Did he own a barbershop? I can't remember, but he was very enterprising. He ended up settling down and married one of my aunties. Well, married my auntie. She was an aunt by marriage. And the man that he was prior to leaving for the tour in Vietnam was a completely different individual than the man who came back. And over the years, I watched him struggle and deal with mental illness and deal with a whole host of other things that were compounded as a result of not having access to the more maybe alternative and complementary modalities for healing and for actually addressing those things that obviously haunt so many individuals who have experienced and seen things that no one ever should. And you can't just shut the visions off. You can't just, you know, close your ears and shut out the audio replays, you know, over and over again. And so I think it's outstanding that the VA is embracing this alternative practice, which is, I mean, I actually meditate myself, and it has been tremendously helpful for me and so many others. And the VA is just doing so many wonderful things and leading the nation in what, in my opinion, is a model kind of program where it's a multidisciplinary program where multiple modalities are used to support the individual in their journey towards health, wellness, and restoration. And I just think it's outstanding, and want to applaud you for, again, your service and for your contribution to the body of work, as well as to the body of individuals whose lives are saved, whose minds are saved, whose families are restored as a result, because it affects so many individuals, even if, you know, none of us have directly served in the war. I believe that everyone in some shape, form, or fashion has been touched and impacted by it. And I just...
Oops. It must be that troll that came in here. I'll try to get Allie back, but let me get area code 724 real quick. 724, you're not our troll, are you?
No, I'm Tracy.
Tracy,
I do
so
troll
good
around,
to...
but I...
Yeah, we're all capable of doing a little trolling, but something happened in Allie's call
Yeah,
I guess she's
great.
Not dropped, but you are familiar with Bill.
Well, I met him on Facebook after Barbara, what's her name, Bill?
Satura.
Yeah, I can never get that last name.
Me either.
She had introduced
I know
me to
who
you
mean. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, she had mentioned you to me on LinkedIn, and so I went into your website, and then I saw the little Facebook icon, so I went over there to Facebook, and then I went into your page, and you had so many friends of the same as me, and here they were all from Agape, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's beautiful. So, but I actually wanted to thank you for coming on tonight and sharing your story. It really touched me listening since my brother's injury goes back to 45 years out in Los Angeles, actually. And, you know, listening to about the PTSD with, our older veterans, my dad had flown for the Air Force in Canada and also the United States Air Force before becoming a pilot. And he flew the wounded during the war. And then when we're living out in Los Angeles, then my brother ended up getting shot in the head 3 times. And that, I believe, truly brought back his PTSD or it surfaced, you know, that was buried underneath from what he went through in the war. And he ended up having to retire from the airlines. And I had read an article on Brainline.org sometime this past year, that actually, depending on the injury, a lot of times they've done research on this and studies that family members end up having PTSD. And, you know, after reading that article, it just brought up, I think we all, and even my own psychologist that I've sought out recently, in all that I've gone through my brother's journey in traumatic brain injury, that I definitely was suffering from PTSD from the time that he got shot 45 years ago. So it's been an interesting journey for me. And I think through your efforts and Kim's and Les Paul's and all the people associated with Brain Injury Radio and all these organizations that are popping up now, that there's going to be a big shift and change in how TBI is being treated and the perspective of how it's looked at. I'm really encouraged by everyone, and I want to thank you.
Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you, Tracy.
You're welcome.
That's great. Well, again, William Roper, Compassionate Warrior, check him out. You'll find him on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore. If you just go in and give the name, check out his website, tbivet.com. And, William, I want to thank you so much for being here tonight and sharing your encouraging and inspirational message, which we try to do here on Recovery Now, that it might not go back to 100% the old way, but there's a lot of grace in the determination of trying. And right. And in fact, we see results. So I wish you the best of luck with your new book.
Well, thank you so much, Kim. I appreciate you.
All right. Well, I won't keep you any longer, and hope you'll come back and see us again.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. And you can hang on for just one moment before you hang up, okay?
All right.
And then you can. This is a little something I like to do for our veterans, and many of you know I spend some of the second part of my show doing music from independent musicians. I typed in the chat room, if you happen to be on Facebook, if you happen to go to YouTube is what I meant, YouTube, and type in the search window, Chris Dukes, D-U-K-E-S, Heroes. you'll see the video that goes with this song. So again, I want to thank William Roper and all of our veterans, and to them, as an outro, I play Chris Duke's singing Heroes.
Far from Afghanistan, on lonely nighttime watch he hopes silence keeps hold. It's been crazy here and he's been missing home. Their freedom's worth the fight, and a fight is what's in store. With lips upon that picture, he prepares to fight some more. That's a hero.
Thanks again to all of our veterans and to William Roper. That was Chris Dukes. You can find him at chrisdukes.com or on facebook.com/chrisdukesband. And actually, I'm sorry, I think that's chrisdukesband.com is his website. You can find those songs individually on iTunes and Amazon, and I encourage you, if you haven't, to go to YouTube and type in Chris Duke's Heroes and watch the video, wrenching video that he made to go with this tune, but it's in appreciation to our veterans. Some of you, I mentioned earlier that we're watching our Brain Injury Radio Facebook, that it's been a really busy couple weeks for me. I make the joke that my husband and I don't go out after the streetlights go on. I'm night blind, and he's somebody who works at 4 o'clock in the morning and goes to bed at 8:30, something like that, and it doesn't change on the weekends. So it was very interesting. I've been blessed to have these so many wonderful independent musicians let me play their music on my show, and I've gotten a chance. Of course, I have them all over the world now, but you guys have seen me post a couple of pictures where I met locally Nick Johnson and Daniel Christian a couple weeks ago. And some of you might have seen that last weekend it was a doubleheader, nearly killed us. Thank God it was Columbus Day and there was an extra day off, because I got to go. This is a little story I'll tell. Les Paul has heard it before, but when I cast my net the first time to find these indie musicians, six came in on the net. And interestingly, and how things seem to work in my life, two of those musicians just knew I was looking for a musician and I had a radio show. They didn't know what it was about. When they heard it was about Brain Injury Radio, we all kind of sat there with our mouths agape a little bit, because two out of those six had something brain-related going on in their lives. And one of them was an old friend, and one of them is a new friend I met for the first time the other night. The other one, John Cruz, is who I'm going to play first. John, I had known for, 15 or 20 years. I used to go to one night I was sitting in a restaurant. It was a restaurant bar, Italian place, and my girlfriends and I were in eating, and I heard this music on, and I was just blown away. I kind of spaced off what my friend was saying, and I stood up and I walked out into the bar and I looked up at this man who was the archetype of the blues singer. He looked rode hard, put up wet, had his Jack Daniels and Coke in front of him, and was going out for his smoke breaks, and he could blow a harmonica that would bring you to your knees, sing with a passion that would bring tears to your eyes, and play a guitar like no other. And I used to go and watch them regularly. And then, as things happen, I guess I got married. They tore down Trovato's. The band had a Yoko moment and broke up, and it had been years since I had seen them. But I had the CD they had made, and I had kept that all these years, and finding John was like looking for a needle in a haystack, but I did find him. And when I got a hold of him, he remembered me, and we had a nice conversation, and then he proceeded to tell me that a month before, he was diagnosed with a tumor on his brainstem, and that he was going to be going through about 38 radiation treatments, not with the hope of getting rid of this inoperable tumor, but in hopes of helping it to not grow, or at least not grow as fast. And I'm praying that will be the case. Back when I knew John the first time, his daughter, Lindsay, was 12, and he raised her on his own because her mother had been murdered in a violent crime. And I usually play Palm of Your Hand, which I might play later, and that was in response to that to that episode, but he's been a wonderful blues singer and writer, and I got to go hear him the other night. We have a barbecue joint, McKenna's Blues, Booze, and Barbecue, and he and one of the old members of his band were playing. And this is the second time my husband and I have gotten to go see him. And I got a couple of new tunes tonight, and one of them that I really liked is called Sweet Tennessee. So, again, John's going to be finding out in the next 10 days or so if this radiation did anything for him. And I just feel like I was really blessed. I've been really blessed to get to see him again the last couple times and get the pictures. And if you guys are looking on the Brain Injury Radio Facebook page, it's the one of me with the man with the U.S. Marine Corps T-shirt under his shirt. And I'm kind of giving him a thumbs up in my black hat. But this is called Sweet Tennessee.
You can't stop the winds of change. You can't turn the sands of time. Doors they open up before your eyes, a brand new world for her to find. She's with the captain of her soul, sailing on a sea of life, taking her home. If I could just one more time bring her back to me, yeah, we need one more time in sweet Tennessee. I found myself, then I found love. It's kept me strong since you've been gone. We think about you every day. Our love for you lives on. She's with the captain of her soul, sailing on a sea of life, taking her home. If I could just one more time bring her back to me, yeah, we'd meet one more time in sweet Tennessee. You know our daughter grew up true and strong. You gave her the will to carry on. She's a life like you. And me, I just play in an old blues band, waiting at the station for the train to carry me home again. She's with the captain of her soul, sailing on a sea of life, taking her home. If I could just one more time bring her back to me, yeah, we'd meet one more time in sweet Tennessee. Soul, sea of life, taking her home. If I could just one more time bring her back to me, yeah. We meet one more time in sweet Tennessee. We dance in the moonlight of sweet Tennessee. We'd make love one more time in sweet Tennessee. Sweet Tennessee, sweet Tennessee, sweet Tennessee, sweet Tennessee, sweet Tennessee, sweet Tennessee.
That's John Cruz, formerly of John Cruz Blues, and he shared with me that he's been doing a lot of writing. You talk about determination. He also, like William, has had a lot of determination in believing that tumor will miraculously disappear. And I, as some of you know, I had my own experience with my own brain injury, and I felt like I saw something the other night. And while John has written a lot of songs, and I'll play you other ones over time, some great heartfelt songs, he sang one of someone else's the other night, and it wasn't someone I had heard of before. The guy's name was Coco Montoya, and M-O-N-T-O-Y-A, Coco Montoya, Good Days, Bad Days. And I heard, it just blew me away. And I'm trying to get Coco Montoya, so I'm not going to say, but because he had a studio and he is a phenomenal guitar player, and the song is really great, but John and guitar George the other night, just the two of them in that restaurant, played this song. And John has such a richness and depth dimension to his voice. And he too is a Vietnam veteran, that, well, one of my goals is that I'm hoping that John is going to be able to put together his third CD with the kind of music and thought that he's turned to and been writing on during the time that he's known he's had this cancer in his head, and what can happen not only from his treatments, but the brain stem is kind of control central in the brain, and if that grows in any given direction, it isn't real great news. In any case, again, I appreciate your thoughts and prayers going up for John, and I'm going to look forward to seeing if I can get him to tape, pay, and arrange to have him tape Coco's song, and that would be, like, really awesome for me, and I think for him, too. He's dang good at it. The other picture you might have seen this week on Saturday night, it was bad enough. I dragged my husband out on Friday night, and many of you also know he's a government worker, so he's been furloughed a lot. And then they decided that because he trains essential personnel, he's essential personnel. So he's back to work, and it had been like his first week, and we went out and saw John on Friday night, and then on Saturday night, for Pete's sake, the second person in my first draw of musicians is a guy named Dale Hayes. He has a band called Garden GarFan, GARFAN.com. And when I talked to him, it was about the same thing. I was just asking about music and looking for permission to play it on my song. And I started telling him what we do here and a little bit about my story. And he instantly changed. Dale's wife is Deborah. And in 2001, she had a brain aneurysm, much like mine, and she didn't fare as well. And a few of you on here heard me tell you that, I cried. That was the night that Craig introduced me to the concept, the bureaucratic word threshold. And that's something where a pencil pusher goes in and decides based on some bureaucratic criteria whether you're progressing fast enough in a timely fashion from a brain injury. And if you're not, your treatment is withheld and you're punted into a nursing home with older folks. And Deborah's been there for 8 years. And Dale has stayed married to her, very devoted to her. He just released his third CD, Dinner for One. You can find him at garfan.com. I also posted these on that Facebook page. You can always ask me questions, too, if there's something you don't catch that's on my show, by going to inaflash.org. And going to the contact author tab, and that'll send me an email. But in any case, the Dale I hadn't had a chance to meet. He lives in Lincoln, which is about an hour and a half away from here. And we don't go to Lincoln. I told you we don't even go out here after the street lights are on. And Dale's come to town a couple of times, and we just haven't been able to go and meet him. But Dale felt particularly bonded. He was a guest on a show one night, and Les Paul and Keith Anthony, a lot of the other regulars at the time, and I think Craig was there, were all very helpful and welcoming to Dale, and nobody had given him much information at all. Les Paul helped him in some resources having to do with independent living, and I helped him get a life insurance policy on Deborah. It had been so long she's been in this nursing home that some of her family was even not seeing her anymore because they quote-unquote couldn't stand to see her that way. And so in the meantime, Dale had developed diabetes, and in the last year and a half has gone blind and had to have a leg amputated. And he's still playing, and he's still going to see Deborah as often as he can get a ride. But he learned a very important lesson, both from Deborah's story and then his own, and their story together. And he wrote this song. I was very pleased to get to meet him for the first time in person Saturday night in another bar restaurant. So for Gary and I, it was really kicking up our heels this weekend. And, of course, a few days before, again, I got to meet my sponsor, Marilyn Lash of Lash Publishing, and the new executive director of Nebraska's Brain Injury Association. So I've just really been mixing it up the last few days. So I crashed like a rock on Columbus Day. But this is Dale Hayes and Garfan singing something we're all real familiar with. And that's a Borrowed Time.
Mm-hmm. see, I'm living on borrowed time 'cause of you. Today's borrowed time, thanks to you. It's just borrowed time, now I'm through. You dismissed my phone call and you ignored my letters. My systems are turning down just the one at a time. And all you care about is how to save a lousy dime. You see, I'm living on borrowed time. Borrowed time, thanks to you.
Again, that was Garfan with Borrowed Time. And I think I'll go ahead and open the mics for a little bit now. We got about a half hour left in the show. I think Bill might have stayed with us.
Yes, ma'am. I'm here.
Good. I certainly didn't expect you to, but that's good that you're on the West Coast, so you're not up as late as some of the rest of us. But we've got Bill Roper, our guest, and Allie, and from the D.C. area, and our southern gentleman, Les Paul, from South Carolina, on the board, and Keith Anthony, our Saturday night host, is from Croydon, England, and so he's up early to hear you, Bill, real early, and a couple of other guests going on. So anyway, I want to welcome you all again to Brain Injury Radio. Yes, and we're having a British invasion, yes. But he's not on the board, so I don't know. In any case, I just thought that that was pretty amazing. I had known we were going to be seeing John Cruise for a few weeks, and Dale had just written me like the day before, and I thought, oh gosh, it was just one of those things, but this bar restaurant was as close as they were going to get, and so it was really a pleasure to get to see John, and a pleasure to meet Dale in person, as it was my sponsor. So it was kind of a banner week of getting to meet people. Most of my guests and my fellow hosts are all over the world, and you know, I'm the one tucked away here in the Midwest, and so it's been pretty cool. I've gotten some good guests from my area, which I didn't even know there were any fellow survivors in my area until I say it took me 17 years writing a book and becoming a radio host to meet any other survivors. And then the first ones I met were out around the world, and little by little I'm running into a few of them around here too, both musicians and guests like Bill last week. So yeah, Les Paul, once you become aware, I guess, and maybe that was something I could really relate to what you were talking about, Bill, about the avoidance part of it, because since there wasn't, I don't want to go through my whole thing, but I fell through medical cracks, and so I wasn't having a lot of follow-up. They said I was a success, and that was mostly because they put that piece of my skull they sawed out back in after they put a clip, you know, in my brain and flipped my face back up and sewed me back together. When he said, your surgery is a success, I thought that meant success in another context. I thought it meant a success forever, and that's not exactly how it happened. And so when you talked about wanting to be in denial and wanting to practice avoidance, now I didn't really have a choice about practicing avoidance. There was nothing there to avoid, but I know that my family, people that I worked with, you know, like you said, as soon as I looked normal and was back to walking and talking, I think they thought I was a sluffer too, and that, you know, I was just broken. Heck, the surgeon said it was a success. And so they enabled me to perpetuate my denial that there wasn't anything wrong. And so I could really relate to that part of your story, and that's part of what took me so long to sit down and write the book that I did, and not too long after that to get involved in radio. So I'm not sure that that's an uncommon thing, although I know, you know, in Les Paul's area, and also Craig, the founder of our show, of our network, Brain Injury Radio, that they're in a place where there's a very strong presence of brain injury support groups and things like that, association activity and but still, it's hard, like you say, not everybody wants to go that route, and the choice was taken away from me. I guess there was something that I could have gone to, but my mom thought if I saw other people worse than me, it might hold me back. So, you know, that decision, I guess, allowed me to operate in my case, my faith in God, because I was a little shaken about my determination factor and my confidence level, but I was a fighter. I had always been a fighter, and so you know, I was pretty determined too, but that can be a pretty isolating, polarizing experience if you're doing it on your own and you're not dispensing of that toxicity like you're talking about through a process like meditation. The rest of you guys have your mics open. We have about 30 minutes left in the show. So, Allie, Les Paul, if there's anything else you'd like to say, or Bill?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
I unmuted all of you after Dale. I thought I'd play, you know, it was a sequence in my mind. Here's how the brain works. My guest was on. He's a Vietnam veteran. I just saw John Cruz Friday night. He's a Vietnam veteran and has a brain tumor. And then the next night, got to see for the first time, meet for the first time Dale, whose wife had a circumstance much like mine, and where I learned some really big lessons from that interview that I did with him. And John's going to be on the show in a few weeks. I'm going to do an interview with him, but some of the things I learned in Dale's interview were real eye-openers. And so that's kind of how my mind worked is, you know, William is my featured guest tonight, but I just happened to get to see John and Dale this weekend, and so thought I'd play a cut of theirs. I'm praying that John's going to keep being able to do that.
Yes. Well, a minute ago, I just wanted to say this. Allie asked a question a minute ago, and I posted something, and I don't think she understood what I was saying. It was kind of a joke, but not a good one, apparently. I was saying that brain injury survivors are literally falling from the trees since we became involved with Brain Injury Radio. Wouldn't you say that, Kim? Everywhere you turn your head, you meet a brain injury survivor is what I meant. I didn't fully explain that, Allie. That's what I was talking about.
Oh, yeah. No, I understand that. And that, Allie, part of that comes from, you know, me saying, unless, you know, Les Paul, but I've said a number of times on here, it took 17 years writing a book and becoming a radio host for me to meet my first survivors. And then when I just made reference a couple times to the first time I cast my net for musicians. Well, I've done that again and again. I probably have 20 some odd musicians now, so that process kept going. And I made a comment at one time, you know, life really turns the tables on you. I went so long never dreaming I'd be looking for any musicians or being involved with any brain injury things, and all of a sudden I can't swing a cat without finding an independent musician or somebody who's had a brain injury. And it's just,
exactly. It's
kind of a wild dynamic when you've lived 18 years without even knowing another one existed or even really realizing I was one for the first decade, you know.
I imagine you walked past a lot not knowing it. I really do. I'll just bring
absolutely
up something real quick if I can. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
You probably remember me talking about this, but Allie might not, and a few other people that might be listening, or a lot of other people might be listening. Our local news media came out to an event that we were having for our brain injury, a group over in Augusta one time, and a new news reporter for a local television station, after walking around, she said, pardon me, sir. And I said, yes, ma'am. She said, could you show me any brain injury survivors? I would like to know where some are. I don't see any. It's something along those lines. I'm forgetting the words that were said, but I remember the story. And I started laughing. I cracked up because there were about 17 of us standing all around her, and she didn't know any of us were brain injury survivors because it's a hidden, silent epidemic, and none of us appeared to have brain injuries. And she said, why are you laughing? And I said, well, turn your head any direction, you'll see a brain injury survivor. And she said, I don't understand. What do you mean? And I'm saying, if you look that way, you'll see a brain injury survivor to your left or to your right. Or if you turn around behind you, you'll see one. And by the way, hi, I'm one. She goes, oh, what? You're a brain injury survivor? No, you're kidding. Really, where are the brain injury survivors? I'm saying, oh, no, she doesn't know I'm serious.
Right,
so,
well, yeah.
She wanted to interview some, and she couldn't find anybody. And if she would have left there, she would have said, I'm sorry, there's no brain injury survivors there. And so we all started laughing together, and she said, don't tell me you're all brain injury survivors. And we all raised our hands. And she goes, oh, dear God, I did not know that. Are you really serious? And that's when I said it is a hidden, silent epidemic that's going around the world, and got serious about it. And so she went on and did an interview, not knowing
I
she was standing with me.
I think that's great, because I think people have a preconceived notion as to what a brain injury looks like. And
yeah.
A lot of times that's maybe a developmental thing, or, you know, the kids you see working as sackers at your grocery store, some of those jobs that we've talked about,
yeah.
And that's not always the case, but people are painting brain injury with a very broad brush out of ignorance, and I think, I affectionately, I say ignorance, because everybody is until they're educated, you know, to what reality is and how the cow eats the cabbage. And I think that's what we're trying to do, what Bill's trying to do in his book. And you know, the story I was trying to tell on myself before I got involved, and, you know, what we're trying to do on Brain Injury Radio Network, as well as the 4-PIER-11 line. And that's just to help educate people. And now that we're going to be, and I did challenge all of you other hosts out there, if you haven't done it already, or listeners, that Susan Connors, president of the National Brain Injury Association, and she gave the nod to posting Brain Injury Radio on their website, and that gave my new executive director here in Nebraska the courage to be a trailblazer and to put our link on the Nebraska page. And so if National can give it the nod, and Nebraska can be one of the first to step up to the plate, or in the first to step up to the plate, I hope that you'll all talk to your associations or alliances, if you have them in your state, and suggest that they do the same. Because if I'm not mistaken, at least what I'm seeing is that there's been a big gap in peer-to-peer support. And I know that there's some people that just don't want to go down that road, and that's their personal right for their personal reasons. But what I do want is for people to have a choice. And that's something that they haven't had in the past, and it's cost them their families, their marriages, jobs they've tried to have, their psyche, and sometimes their lives. It's cost them dearly. So I think the more we can get the word out that people have a choice, then if they do want to reach out, it ain't going to be that hard to find another survivor like it is right now, or had been. You know, things have changed a lot in the year that we've been here, and I imagine some in the 3 since Craig started the station.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing what we've seen, isn't it? And the new wonderful people we've been meeting, it blows my mind, all the fabulous people we've met since this started.
Yeah, and people willing to talk, which I appreciate, you know, them sharing their stories because it gives hope. You know, what Bill talked about earlier, I know there's times when people try to do something they used to do proficiently and can't, and it's very hard to get angry and frustrated. And if you don't have any guidance or any, I use the phrase arrows in your quiver, tools in your toolbox of recovery, then it can be hard or almost impossible to overcome. And by putting these things out there, people have the opportunity to try. You know, there's nothing about meditation that's going to hurt you. Somebody might be afraid to go to a chiropractor because they think they'll get their neck broke, and I'm not so sure I disagree. But, you know, something like breathing oxygen, I would think, or you know, cranial sacral work or meditation or the EFT, I can't see where those would hurt anybody.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the visual imagery and hypnotherapy type work that Keith Anthony does. Those are certainly companion treatments that can't hurt you, and if they can help you and you're sick and tired of being sick and tired and desperate enough, it'll be something you'll try.
Yes, it sure is. And he's helped us so many different times, Keith has, with his hypnotherapy, and there's some wonderful people we've met like that.
Yeah, that's right. What happened, I had to walk away from the studio in the chat room for a moment. Is Allie still on?
I
opened
her mic.
Right,
I'm okay. Here. Yes,
oh, okay.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hello. sorry about that. Something was happening Saturday night, too, where odd thing. I don't know. You were there Saturday, weren't you? Odd things were happening in the chat room and on the switchboard. And I'm not sure if it's Blog Talk Radio or if maybe we're having some transitional things going on and that we should be moving to our own new studio here in, what, a week or two? Les Paul?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
I'm thinking. We're all having a little...
I was talking to Craig about it today.
Uh-oh. Yeah, we've been having a little nervous anxiety about starting something new. And so be real anxious to start getting our lessons and feel confident and determined that I'm going to learn it and it's going to be like this. Doable. Well, okay. I think what I'll do, we've got Bill or one of you. You sound tired. You must be still working hard, Les Paul.
I've been saying lately that I've been challenging myself, and I find myself working. Mm-hmm. Late today is an example, and I'm saying, wow, I didn't know I could do this because there was times in the past where I absolutely could not have done what I did today, and then I got really tired, but then I got back up 30 minutes later and kept on going all the way up until time for your show to start tonight. And that's not, I hope that doesn't sound like I'm bragging because it's not what I mean it to mean. It means I hope everybody will find whatever level of comfort they can handle and levels of mild stress that you can push the envelope just a little bit, kind of like Chuck Yeager would do back in the old days when they were trying to break speed and sound records, you know, break the sound barrier, and then the fastest cars, the fastest everything. That we're trying to do it safely and kindly, but at the same time, challenge yourself to break a new barrier down, because people with brain injuries have a lot of barriers in front of them, and they've been placed there, some of them real and some of them not real. Some of them are in our head, literally. And
that's true.
I've been challenging myself to to test my limits. And at times I've found them here lately. I'm like, oh, boy, I've got to go lay down for a while. I'm exhausted. But then I get up and keep on going. And that's what I just saw some claiming power in type, a way to go increasing your stamina. That's what I mean. I couldn't think of the word stamina. I am tired, but I don't feel bad. I'll be fatigued and I'll go to bed after a while. That's the best I can say.
Cool. The humility thing, and you talking about some of the things you were talking about on your show last night, I found this passage on the word humility, and a lot of people get humility mixed up with humiliation, and it's really opposite.
That's a good way to say it.
Yeah. I heard a short version. I'm going to read you the longer one in a minute. The short version was not humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less often.
Okay.
That was the one I heard.
That's
but,
great right there.
But,
I like that.
Yeah, make a note of that. I'll read you somebody else's now. That was that was the one I came up with. But this one says humility is perpetual quietness of heart. It is to have no trouble. It is never to be fretted or vexed, irritable or sore, to wonder nothing that is done to me, to feel nothing done against me. It is to be at rest when nobody praises me and when I am blamed or depressed. It is to have a blessed home in myself where I can go in and shut the door and kneel to my Father in secret and be at peace as in a deep sea of calmness when all around about is seeming trouble.
Oh.
And what are the sources of these definitions, Kim?
This source came from Hazleton, a daily meditation book from Hazleton. And I liked that, whether a person has, and we've talked on here before, and that'll be another discussion. I won't go into length because we're running down the hour, but, whether a person has any religious affiliation or not, I draw a distinction between religiosity and spirituality, and lean toward the spirituality part of it. And so, you know, even in a case of meditation, like we were talking about earlier, just the place where to have a blessed home in myself, where I can go and shut the door and kneel, whether it's to your internal higher power or to however you would define your higher power, in secret and be at peace, as in a deep sea of calmness when all around about is seeing trouble. So that's kind of what meditation and yoga conjured in my mind tonight was not only determination, but determination with a healthy dose of humility. So anyway, I guess that brings us down to about the end. So I want to thank you very much again for coming, William Roper, and that's a compassionate warrior. Check him out at tbivet.com.
Yeah. And they can go to my website, tbivet.com, and there's a lot of articles and blog posts that I do about all of this.
Okay.
The blog posts should be interesting.
Great. Well, we'll be looking forward to seeing that. And thanks to Les Paul, Allie, Keith Anthony, Tracy was here earlier, and all of you out there listening, thank you for supporting Brain Injury Radio, and thank you for supporting my show, Recovery Now. I'm going to close the show out in my usual way, and that's with something I believe we all have. And be sure to check her out at leahwest.com. This is Guardian Angel. Good night, everybody, and God bless.
Good night.
Little baby up in heaven says to God, do I really have to go? And God replies, yes, it's your time to leave. But don't you worry, you won't be there alone. You see, there's someone who's been waiting for you.
Okay, everybody. Yes, we got 10 seconds, so I want to, again, thank you for being here, and I appreciate William Roper and everyone who supports Brain Injury Radio, and I hope you enjoy Leah West. Check her out at leahwest.com, and good night, everybody.